wings.org. Wings thanks all our friendly supporters, including Genevieve Vaughn, Suzette Cullen, and your local community radio station. Wings makes programs available to stations free of charge. Inquire by email, wings@wings.org. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
You're listening to Kingston's only campus community radio station, broadcasting 24/7, 365 on 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca. Tune in for the best local programming.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Truly, we will not stop supporting Gaza or abandon it. We hope in this new year that God grants us his victory and that he grants victory to those resisting among us in Gaza. We stand with them until death. We approach this with determination and willpower, using all the strength we can muster.
Israeli airstrikes in Gaza have already killed 52 Palestinians since dawn on the second day of 2025, including women and children in so-called humanitarian zones. We'll go to Gaza for an update from Palestinian journalist Shru'ela. Her husband and fellow journalist Roshdi Saraj was killed in an Israeli airstrike more than a year ago. She was recently honored by the Committee to Protect Journalists.
The coverage cannot convey for the audience the smell of death. Everywhere you go, there is the smell of death. And it brings me back to the zero moment, to the moment I lost my dear husband, Roshdi.
And as we begin 2025, we look at how the world is cracking down on migrants and the dangers they face when they flee their countries due to persecution, economic conditions, or the climate crisis. In Greece, prosecutors have opened a murder investigation of, quote, unknown perpetrators following a damning BBC expose of the deadly crackdown on asylum seekers by the Greek Coast Guard, with evidence showing they abducted and abandoned asylum seekers in the Mediterranean Sea, where thousands have died.
They started with a Cameroonian. They threw him in the water. The Ivorian said, "Save me. I don't want to die. Save me." An incredible strength animated me. I survived.
He swam to safety, but the other two men died.
We'll speak with BBC producer Lucille Smith about her investigation, Dead Calm, Killing in the Med. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Gaza, Israeli attacks have killed at least 52 Palestinians since dawn after a wave of strikes that killed 28 people on New Year's Day, including women and children. Israeli air attacks struck northern Gaza's Jabalia, the central Berej refugee camp, Gaza City, and a tent camp sheltering displaced families in Almawasi and southern Khan Yunis, in an area designated by Israel as a so-called humanitarian zone. This comes as a seventh infant in Gaza has died from hypothermia, while displaced people in tents struggle to keep warm amidst days of heavy rain.
We are living here in the cold, in a state of hunger and thirst, lacking clothes, blankets, and mattresses. The rain pours on us all night while the tarps leak and no one acknowledges us. Last year, we lived in Rafah. Before that, we were in Beit Lahia. Then we moved to Rafah, and from Rafah, we came to Khan Yunis. We still don't know what our fate is or where we will be relocated next.
New data show Gaza's population has fallen by 6% since the start of Israel's assault in October of 2023. The Palestinian Central Bureau of Statistics estimates about 100,000 people have left Gaza, while more than 55,000 have been killed by Israeli attacks or are missing and presumed dead. In the occupied West Bank, the Palestinian Authority says it's temporarily halted the Al Jazeera TV network from operating or broadcasting in the territory, citing what it called inciting material and reports that were deceiving and stirring strife. This follows Al Jazeera's critical coverage of the Fatah faction, which dominates the PA, as well as recent deadly clashes between Palestinian security forces and armed Palestinian groups. Al Jazeera condemned the move to censor its coverage as, quote, nothing but an attempt to dissuade the channel from covering the rapidly escalating events, they said. Here in the United States, President Biden says the man who drove a pickup truck into throngs of New Year's revelers in New Orleans early Wednesday had posted videos to social media hours earlier pledging allegiance to the militant group ISIS. The attack killed 15 people and wounded at least 35 others, carving a path of destruction down Bourbon Street before the assailant was killed in a firefight with police officers. President-elect Trump responded on social media, writing, "When I said that the criminals coming in are far worse than the criminals we have in our country, that statement was constantly refuted by Democrats and the fake news media, but it turned out to be true," Trump wrote. However, President Biden revealed the suspect is a 42-year-old U.S. citizen from Texas named Shamsuddin Jabbar, who was born in Texas.
He served in the United States Army on active duty for many years. He also served in the Army Reserve until a few years ago. The FBI also reported to me that mere hours before the attack, he posted videos on social media indicating that he's inspired by ISIS, expressing a desire to kill.
The annual college football game, hosted at the nearby Superdome, the Sugar Bowl, was delayed for 24 hours following the attack. The FBI said it found an explosive device in the Ford F-150 pickup truck used by the suspect. Shamsuddin Jabbar had two prior criminal offenses, one in 2002 for theft and another in 2005 for driving with an invalid license. Jabbar obtained a real estate license in 2019. The following year, he posted a video to YouTube introducing himself as a professional real estate agent. Court documents showed Jabbar struggled with his finances. In 2020, his second wife, his ex-wife, was granted a restraining order forbidding Jabbar from sending threatening messages or causing bodily injury to his spouse or their child. The Sugar Dome has now been delayed until Thursday. In Nevada, one person was found dead and seven others injured Wednesday morning when a Tesla Cybertruck filled with fuel canisters and fireworks exploded outside the Trump International Hotel in Las Vegas. Surveillance video shows the vehicle parking directly in front of the hotel before suddenly erupting in flames moments later. The blast sent up a huge column of smoke, but caused only minor damage to the hotel. The FBI said it was investigating whether the incident was an act of terrorism and whether it might be connected to the attack in New Orleans earlier Wednesday. The Cybertruck was rented in Colorado by someone using the same car rental app used by the New Orleans assailant. But so far, officials have not publicly identified the body found inside the vehicle and have not determined whether the explosion was intentional. Meanwhile, the FBI says it collected more than 150 pipe bombs during a December raid on a 20-acre property in eastern Virginia. It was the largest cache of homemade explosives ever found by the agency. Federal prosecutors have described the accused bomb maker, 36-year-old Brad Spofford, as an anti-government extremist who used a photo of President Joe Biden for target practice as he pursued a sniper qualification. The Pentagon says it launched a wave of airstrikes on Sana'a and other parts of Yemen on Tuesday. U.S. Central Command says it targeted Houthi command and weapons production facilities. The attacks came just after Israel bombed the Yemeni port city of Hodeidah and the main airport in Sana'a, killing at least six people. A Houthi spokesperson said Wednesday that the Houthis would continue attacking aimed at ending Israel's assault on Gaza.
The Yemeni armed forces affirm their continued operations in support of Gaza, and these operations will not stop until the aggression on Gaza is stopped and the siege is lifted.
In Ukraine, two people were killed and six others wounded Wednesday as Russia's military began the new year with fresh airstrikes on the capital, Kyiv. The attacks came as the Russian fossil fuel giant Gazprom said it had halted the flow of gas to Europe via pipelines crossing Ukraine. Until January 1st, Kyiv had allowed Russian oil and gas to cross Ukrainian territory for decades, even after Russia's 2022 invasion, providing a major source of revenue to both Ukraine and Russia. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky hailed the halt of the Russian gas shipments as one of Moscow's biggest defeats. Meanwhile, Russia says about 10,000 volunteers have joined efforts to contain a massive oil spill from two tankers in the Kerch Strait near the Ukrainian territory of Crimea, which Russia invaded and annexed in 2014. Since mid-December, the storm-stricken tankers have spilled 200,000 tons of heavy fuel oil, fouling dozens of miles of shoreline. So far, Russia says it's removed more than 70,000 tons of contaminated sand and soil. The Honduran President Xiomara Castro has warned she might seek to cancel military cooperation with the United States if President-elect Trump makes good on his promises of mass deportations, denial of asylum claims, and family separations at the U.S.-Mexico border. Castro made the warning in a New Year's Day message in which she called for constructive dialogue with the incoming administration.
Faced with a hostile attitude of mass expulsion of our brothers, we would have to consider a change in our policies of cooperation with the United States, especially in the military arena, where, without paying a cent for decades, they maintain military bases in our territory, which in this case would lose all reason to exist in Honduras.
The president of the Ivory Coast, or Côte d'Ivoire, says he's asked France to withdraw its troops from the West African country. Ivory Coast officially gained independence from French colonial rule in 1960, but France has maintained a military presence for decades, with some 600 soldiers remaining in the country when President Alassane Ouattara announced they would have to depart.
My dear compatriots, dear brothers and sisters, we can be proud of our army, whose modernization is now a reality. It is within this framework that we have decided on the coordinated and organized withdrawal of French forces from Côte d'Ivoire.
This follows the expulsion of French troops from several other African nations in recent months: Mali, Burkina Faso, Niger, Senegal, and Chad. Of Africa's former French colonies, only Djibouti and Gabon will continue to host French forces. South Korea's impeached former president has pledged to fight until the end as he resists a warrant for his arrest over his short-lived declaration of martial law in December. On Tuesday, a court in Seoul ordered Yoon Suk-yeol to be detained and for his office and residence to be searched. So far, Yoon's presidential security service has blocked investigators' access amidst objections by his lawyers. Investigators have until January 6 to execute their search warrant, but can request an extension. If convicted of leading a rebellion, Yoon faces life in prison or the death penalty in South Korea. In more news from South Korea, police have raided the offices of Jeju Air as officials probe the cause of the flight that crashed at Muan International Airport on Sunday, killing 179 people. Officials say a flight data recorder recovered from the wreckage of the Boeing 737-800 aircraft was damaged and will have to be sent to the United States for analysis by the NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board, and Boeing. And North Carolina's outgoing Democratic Governor Roy Cooper has commuted the sentences of 15 people on death row to life imprisonment without possibility of parole. Governor Cooper announced the commutations Tuesday as one of his final acts as governor before Democratic Governor-elect Josh Stein took the oath of office on New Year's Day. The ACLU of North Carolina welcomed the commutations, writing, quote, "We have long known that the death penalty in North Carolina is racially based, unjust, and immoral, and the governor's actions today pave the way for our state to move towards a new era of justice," unquote. The ACLU added, "With 121 people still on death row in our state, we know there is much more work to be done." And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman. When we come back, we begin our first live show of the new year in Gaza, where we speak with Palestinian journalist Shruk Allah. She was recently honored by the Committee to Protect Journalists. Stay with us.
I long to be lazy. I want to be lazy. I long to be out in the sun with no work to be done under that awning they call the sky, stretching and yawning, and let the silly old world go by. Won't a piece do the deep tangle wildwood count in sheep till I sleep like a child.
That's Lazy by the Georgians in 1924. One of the many recordings, movies, and books entering the commons at the start of this new year on what's been dubbed Public Domain Day in the United States. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show in Gaza. Israeli strikes killed 28 Palestinians on New Year's Day, including women and children. Today, Israeli attacks killed at least 52 Palestinians since dawn, striking northern Gaza's Jabalia, the central Berej refugee camp, Gaza City, and a tent camp sheltering displaced families in Al-Mawasi in southern Khan Yunis, in an area designated as a so-called humanitarian zone.
When the morning came, we came to inspect the site, and as you can see, it is devastation, complete destruction. What have the children done to be hit at 1 a.m? There is no safe area at all. No safe area. Wherever you go, those by the sea have been hit, here has been hit, there were strikes further away, the strikes are everywhere.
This comes as a seventh infant in Gaza has died from hypothermia as displaced people in tents struggle to keep warm in the winter amidst days of heavy rain that flooded the camps. This comes as a UN Human Rights Office report released Tuesday documented how Israeli attacks on hospitals between October 2023 and June 2024 have pushed Gaza's healthcare system to the brink of collapse. This is Eman Abu Hatab, a Palestinian father seeking medical attention for his son at a flooded field hospital in Nasser Medical Complex in Khan Yunis.
I came to treat my son, but I found the hospitals in such a state, as you can see. This is a situation unfit for any hospital in the entire world. This is but the least of the problems for our children. We want the Arab countries to see what's happening to us for the sake of the hospitals, because everything is flooded.
New data shows the Gaza population has fallen 6% since the start of Israel's assault on Gaza more than a year ago. For more, we go to Deir al-Balah in Gaza to speak with Shruk Allah, independent journalist and producer in Gaza. She was recently honored by the Committee to Protect Journalists, that's CPJ, in their 2024 International Press Freedom Awards. Her husband, the journalist Roshdi Siraj, was killed in an Israeli airstrike in October 2023. He ran In Media, which Shruk now heads. CPJ described Shruk's story as emblematic of the plight of journalists in Gaza, quote, who've endured the unthinkable and continue to report the news for the world to see. Just last Thursday, an Israeli strike killed five Palestinian journalists outside Al-Awda Hospital in the Nusayrat refugee camp in central Gaza. One of those five journalists in their car that was clearly marked press was waiting for his first child to be born inside the hospital. Shruch, welcome back to Democracy Now! Thank you so much for being with us. If you can describe the scene on the ground as we hear about another baby dying of hypothermia, the winter weather so dangerous for the people of Gaza because of the tents that they are living in, because of their completely devastated condition and the closing of so many hospitals because of airstrikes and raids.
Hey, Emmy, and it's so weird to say Happy New Year from genocide, but hopefully it will be end very soon. So on Tuesday, the rain, storms flooded and uprooted the displacement tents, the makeshift tents of displaced people, like worsening the already deteriorating living conditions of them. Over 2 million displaced people are facing life-threatening conditions because of the extreme cold and the heavy rain. In addition to that, it's important to mention that these tents cannot withstand the heat in summer, and nor can they stand the cold and rain in winter. Even though it's really important to mention that nowadays, like it's been like almost 3 months, the Gaza Strip has been suffering of suffocated siege by the Israeli army, and making more, you know, tightening the siege to prevent the entry of basic needs. Like, for example, there is a shortage of blankets, mistries, warm clothing, and very little wood for fires. And this, the current situation actually signals an immediate need for intervention. Otherwise, there will be a real humanitarian crisis that just ahead in the beginning of this winter. In addition to that, there are many kids are suffering of lots of diseases because of the cold. And also, you have to know, when it comes to rain, the sewage got mixed with the rainfall, which involves those kids in more, you know, harsh conditions to cope with inside those tents. It's really heartbreaking to walk in the street and seeing those people putting their blankets, mistries, and all, even the clothes, just in the street, all wet, and just waiting to sun to show up, you know, to dry it all. I've seen kids, you know, trying to help their fathers, their parents, in terms of getting the water out of their tents, because they woke up finding themselves swimming, literally swimming in the rain water and the sewage as well.
Shru, first, it's horrifying to say, just as you said, it's hard to say Happy New Year, as you describe the situation on the ground. But congratulations on winning the CPJ Award, the Committee to Protect Journalists, which has to be also extremely painful for you, as your husband, the journalist Rushdie Siraj, was killed in an Israeli airstrike more than a year ago. And you have so many journalists, well over, what are the numbers, around 170, 80, perhaps more than 200 journalists and media workers killed in Gaza. Most recently, among those killed were the five together outside Al-Awda. And I was wondering if you knew any of them. But talk about the meaning of being recognized for your work.
Like, it's really, I can say it has, you know, double faces in this. The first one, it's really, it acts me deeply to receive awards over the loss of my husband, you know, and you know, not coping, but I can say just, you know, being more resilient and standing in front of the camera or behind the camera and document the horrible situation here. And the good part is in this that people are hearing us. I thought for somehow that I lost hope in humanity, but this award actually brought me to the surface to remind me that what we are doing here under genocide is remarkable. People are hearing us, and you know, they feel us. And from here, I wanted to send my respect and appreciation for all of those who are supporting us and believing in the how exhausting we are. And I can say also, I want to say, I know it's a new year, and I just want to express how exhausted I am. It's not only me. I'm just, you know, I'm representing all of my fellow journalists here. It's been over 14 almost months of being under genocide, doing the coverage day after day, having inside that anxious anger, fear, hunger, and you know, the sense of insecurity above all of this, and also coping with the losing of dear ones, homes, works, and whatever. So I just want to say that we are exhausted, but knowing that people outside are, you know, are awarding us, it's such a relief for us.
Shru, can you describe to us what your day looks like? When you get up in the morning, how you do your work amidst the devastation?
All right, I can say it's such a long day. First of all, since you are living, you are not living alone. You are living with lots of family members and relatives because of that limited spaces that, you know, afforded for people, for displaced people. You know, there is plus 2 million Gazans are displaced now. So, like being in housing in a place with plus 18 person inside, it means that you wake up in the very early morning because of the chaos and noise around you, because of the kids, and also because of that, you know, the so-called safe areas are super crowded with people, so there is always noise to wake you up. And the so I woke up like in the very morning, sometimes at 5 or 6 a.m. And then I want to say that I try as much as I can to have my pure time and moments with my little daughter who got lost her father in the beginning of this genocide. And also because that feel that if I left home, I'm not sure if I'm coming back. So I try as much as I can to catch some moments with her before I leave. And once I leave, you know, there is a transportation crisis here because of the shortage of fuel. So we are using the traditional means of transportation, like that cart tracked by donkeys, for example, that you feel you will never arrive to your destination because it's very slow, and because of the crowdness of the streets outside. But otherwise, the other alternatives are somehow quite expensive and not affordable. And I can say sometimes it takes me two to three hours to arrive to my destination to do the filming. And I have to mention that lots, especially in Khan Yunis city, like the entire city is already, you know, flattened in the ground. Like according to the municipality of Khan Yunis, like 90% of the city destroyed, whether partially or completely destroyed, which means there is no streets. It's all about random shifts, random tents around the everywhere. So, when it comes to filming in Khan Yunis, it means you have to waste your entire day in arriving to the area and leaving the area as well. And also because of the signal there is very weak, because of, you know, not stopping attacking of the networks. And then once I've done my filming, there is another problem, and I can say there's another hardship that we as journalists we are facing, is the issue of the internet access. There is no internet access, a proper one as we used to have before this genocide. So I try to move to the area of the president, because this president provides you with electricity and a suitable internet to do your uploading. And I want to tell you, like, it's been plus 1 year of not lighting the light in the room because there is no electricity. I know that people outside cannot comprehend how does it mean to not have electricity, but it really happens this way. It's just the solar panel alternatives and batteries, which just function, it function for very few hours. And when it comes to winter, you can barely use it.
True. Is it possible for you to leave? And would you leave? Why do you stay there?
You have to know, when this genocide started, I've been uprooted along with my daughter and husband. We were on a work trip outside Gaza. And when it started, we immediately canceled everything and returned to Gaza because my husband and I, we are both journalists, and we believe in that if you are a journalist, you are a journalist for life. And it is just a duty. You have to do it for your company, for your country, for your people, just to be on a duty during such timing. Yeah, I believe that nobody ever imagined it would be as harsh as it is now. But I never regret this because I believe that being here in Gaza means that I'm doing a change. Even this change is not pushing for a ceasefire, but at least people are getting more aware about our suffering and our cause here in the Gaza Strip. And there's also that the other point of this, that it's been almost 7 months of the closure of the Rafah crossing border, which is the only gate out of Gaza that is just connected by the Egyptian authorities. This gate is just closed. This border just closed once in May, the Israeli army launched the military ground operation in the Rafah crossing border and area as well, and causing the damage of this border. So I can say that we are all trapped here. No way out. Just the sky. You die and you fly to the sky. This is the only way out of Gaza nowadays.
True, Ella, I want to thank you so much for being with us, and I wish you all safety for you, for your family, for the people of Gaza. True is an independent journalist in Gaza. Her husband, Roshdi Siraj, was a journalist killed in an Israeli airstrike in October of 2023. He ran in media, which Ella now heads. She was just honored by the Committee to Protect Journalists. Coming up, in Greece, prosecutors have opened a murder investigation of unknown perpetrators following a damning BBC expose on the Greek Coast Guard's deadly crackdown on asylum seekers, with evidence showing they abducted and abandoned asylum seekers in the Mediterranean Sea, where thousands have died. We will speak with the BBC producer behind Dead Calm as we begin this new year, looking at the plight of migrants around the world. Stay with us.
Get up. These, not wasting, swallow by these. I stay knees. I stay knees. Get up.
I've seen footage by Death Grips. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. If you want to sign up for our newsletter, to get a newsletter every day about all the stories that we do, you can go to democracynow.org. As we move into this new year, into 2025, we look at how the world is cracking down on migrants and asylum seekers and the dangers they face as they flee their countries due to many conditions, from persecution to economic conditions to the climate crisis. In Greece, prosecutors have opened a murder investigation of, quote, unknown perpetrators following a damning expose of the deadly crackdown on asylum seekers by Greek authorities. A BBC investigation revealed evidence of the Greek Coast Guard abducting and abandoning asylum seekers in the Mediterranean Sea, where thousands have died, mostly from Africa and the Middle East, as they attempt to reach Europe. The film finds the Greek Coast Guard caused the deaths of as many as 43 migrants in the Mediterranean over a period of 3 years, including of 9 asylum seekers who had reached Greek soil but were taken by the Greek Coast Guard back out to sea, then thrown overboard. The investigation analyzed at least 15 incidents between 2020 and 23, verifying reports made by humanitarian aid groups, which have long accused Greek officials of international crimes as they target asylum seekers, often sabotaging and delaying rescue missions of those adrift at sea. Several eyewitnesses featured in the film corroborate these disturbing accounts. In a minute, we'll bring you our interview on Democracy Now! That I did with Juan Gonzalez with the BBC producer Lucille Smith about the investigation called Dead Calm, Killing in the Med. But first, this clip of Dead Sea Calm that features Ibrahim, a Cameroonian migrant who says he was hunted by Greek authorities after arriving on the Greek island of Samos in 2021 and is now the focus of a new murder investigation by Greek prosecutors.
After crossing from Turkey, he's now a refugee.
There were 2 policemen dressed in black and 3 others in civilian clothes. They were masked.
Ibrahim says he was beaten and strip-searched, and that the Greek Coast Guard took him and 2 other men out to sea.
They started with the Cameroonian. They threw him in the water. The Ivorian said, "Save me. I don't want to die. Save me." An incredible strength animated me. I survived.
He swam to safety, but the other 2 men died. We've heard allegations of a total of 5 separate incidents in which people were thrown into the sea by the Greek Coast Guard. In all, 9 of them died. In a statement, the Greek Coast Guard strongly rejected all accusations of illegal activities and questioned the veracity of the testimonies we've gathered.
That was a clip of the BBC documentary Dead Calm, Killing in the Med. In another part of the film, a former Greek Coast Guard is shown footage of 12 asylum seekers being loaded into a Greek Coast Guard boat, then abandoned on a dinghy in the Mediterranean. He responds to the footage.
I can see people getting on board the vessel. It doesn't seem like it's forceful.
Can you see any small children?
Yes, now I can. That's something that happens. The migrants traveling the Aegean Sea, very often they abandon the children. They don't seem to have the same affection that we have for children.
Do you have any questions about that video?
I don't. Do you need to understand something? That's not me trying to hide something. There are hundreds of videos showing the Greek Coast Guard saving people. Why save someone and let someone else die?
Should we take a break?
Yeah.
Have a cup of tea?
Yeah,
it's
a good moment.
Yeah, great.
I'll visit the loo.
During the break from the interview, the former Greek Coast Guard gets up from his chair. His mic is still on. He begins speaking on the phone to an unnamed person in Greek off camera.
I haven't told them too much. What do you think? Yes, it's crystal clear, but what should I tell them? When you look at it from the outside, it's very clear, isn't it? It's not nuclear physics. I don't know why they did it in broad daylight. It's clearly illegal. Obviously illegal. It's an international crime.
A clip of the BBC doc, Dead Calm. The former Greek Coast Guard caught admitting that actions by Greek authorities are, quote, clearly illegal and international crime, in his own words. This comes as Greek officials leading an independent investigation into a deadly shipwreck last year in the Mediterranean, which led to the deaths of well over 500 asylum seekers, recently summoned the head of Greece's Coast Guard to testify on eyewitness allegations. The Greek Coast Guard tied up the vessel, attempted to pull it, causing the ship to sway, which authorities strongly denied it would capsize and sink. The tragic event is also featured in the BBC investigation. I recently spoke with Lucille Smith, the producer of the BBC documentary titled Dead Calm, Killing in the Med.
The film essentially is it's a 90-minute documentary which looks at and investigates alleged criminality by the Greek Coast Guard. There are two strands to it. On the one hand, we look at the Pylos shipwreck, which was the tragic story of a fishing trawler which left the port city of Tobruk last summer on the 9th of June and tried to journey to Italy. It had about 750 passengers on it. But when it reached Greek territorial search and rescue area in the Mediterranean, it started to call for help. The Italian authorities were made aware of it. The Greek authorities were made aware of it. Frontex, Europe's border agency, was made aware of it. And it sat there for, you know, the authorities had eyes on it for about 14 hours before it capsized. And when we started making, and very sadly, over 600 people drowned, despite the fact that a Greek patrol vessel was there at the time of the capsizing. And so when this catastrophe occurred, lots of journalists started to investigate. And what transpired were allegations by survivors from the shipwreck that the Greek Coast Guard had in fact attempted to tow the vessel into Italian waters, and that in doing so, the ship capsized. And various other things started to come out, that the patrol boat also had their cameras turned off. So a lot of kind of suspicious activity that journalists started to ask questions. And so when the BBC decided to commission this film, Ben Steele, the director, and I, we started investigating and looking into whether there was any kind of precedence of this sort of activity by the Greek Coast Guard. And unfortunately, what we found were very, very dark and serious terrifying stories that are coming out of many of the islands that border Greece and Turkey. Stories of asylum seekers, refugees, migrants arriving on Greek soil, and before they can reach a camp in order to seek asylum, they find themselves kidnapped by men in balaclavas who are armed. They say that they are often beaten. All of their belongings are removed. They are then brought onto a Greek Coast Guard vessel, brought out to sea and dumped in, they call it a life raft. I wouldn't call it a life raft. It's a motorless dinghy, essentially, and left adrift in the sea. Sometimes the Turkish Coast Guard might rescue them. In fact, actually, often they do. But what we found in our investigation was that in many cases, people die. And we found 43 deaths, over 15 cases across 3 years. And some of the stories were just awful. I mean, you heard Ibrahim there. He very bravely gave us his testimony for this film. And in his situation, he was thrown directly into the water without a life vest. The two other individuals he was with also, they drowned very sadly. Before that, he was badly beaten by these men in the balaclavas. We spoke to other survivors. In one case, someone was thrown into the water whilst he had his hands zipped together. We had incidents of allegations of the Greek Coast Guard puncturing the life raft. In one terrible case, They failed to allegedly close the valve on the life raft. We spoke with a survivor who lost his two children and his wife, as well as his nephew, and terrible footage which was released by the Greek Coast Guard, where you watch 11 people drowned in that case, where you watch the father dragging their child through the water. So just absolutely awful stories. And the more and more we read about this, it started to kind of, I guess, strengthen the stories and the allegations that were coming out over what happened with the Pylos shipwreck. And it made it seem like potentially Pylos, that shipwreck, the shipwreck of the Adriana, potentially was, an accident waiting to happen.
And Lucille, could you talk about the overall militarization of the Mediterranean states of Europe against migrants coming from the Middle East or North Africa? And also, what is Frontex?
Sure. That's a great question. I think it's interesting if you look at, let's look at 2015, for example. 2015, we had in Europe 1 million refugees coming over from Syria. And it was very much, it was a shock to Europe. And at that time, I suppose you could say that, particularly if you compare to what's happening now, Europe responded fairly well. I mean, Germany accepted the 1 million refugees. And you had humanitarian organizations going over to Lesbos and Samos and many of the islands in Greece, as well as Italy. Today, it was very much a kind of all hands on deck. And I don't know if you remember the famous photograph of that young child, Alan Kurdi, very sadly, who washed up on the Turkish coast. And there was a kind of outpouring of sympathy. The picture today is very different. If you, as a humanitarian, want to go over to Italy or Greece and help rescue asylum seekers that are attempting to cross, you will most likely be arrested and thrown into prison and charged with smuggling. I mean, Greece's second prison population are made up of smugglers, usually asylum seekers that are the ones that are driving the boat when they reach Greek soil. It's a very, very different picture. I mean, if you look at the number of deaths in 2015 compared to the number of deaths in 2023, it is now 20 times deadlier. And that's with a fraction of the number of people crossing. And even if you compared it to 2014, it's twice as deadly, because obviously 2015, we had so many more people crossing. And so it sort of begs the question of why is it so much deadlier? Why has it become deadlier? And Frontex is Europe's border agency. And Europe's border agency, which kind of manage Europe's border, they provide petrol and money to the nation states for Coast Guard vessels. They provide vessels. They also patrol the coasts of Europe. And we interview the fundamental rights officer in the documentary. But unfortunately, they were quite unwilling to really engage and really unwilling to talk on the record about the reality on the ground and about these allegations and the stories that are coming out of Greece. And in fact, they became so frustrated that they walked out of the interview.
So, in effect, are some claiming that this crackdown on migrants is actually working and leading to fewer people getting into Europe?
Well, Mr. Takis, the Prime Minister of Greece, would say so. He says that he's managed to reduce migration by 90%. I don't know how easy it is to verify that number, but yes, you could say that it is effective. It is a deterrent. And based on the number of refugees that we spoke to, asylum seekers that we spoke to, generally there was a kind of a reluctance to cross to Greece, and people were much keener to go to Italy. So I suppose, yes, you could say that the level of violence that is occurring on these borders is effective in deterring people. But then again, let's face it, you know, people are disappearing. We really have no real clue about the true numbers of the people that are crossing. Many people don't make it. And when people do arrive, they tend to disappear because, as I've just explained, you know, if you are caught by the authorities in Greece, you will be most likely subjected to some very serious violence. So it's very difficult to have a clear answer to that. And I mean, you played a clip as well in there by a former Coast Guard official who was shown some incredible evidence shot by Fayyad Mullah, who is a journalist and an activist based in Austria, showing these men in the balaclavas placing asylum seekers, including a baby and children, onto a Coast Guard vessel, and they were eventually picked up by the Turkish Coast Guard. The former Coast Guard official denied that they understood what they were seeing when during the interview, but during a break, they then revealed that they felt it was what they saw must be an international crime, and this is because this is an open secret. You know, everybody knows this is happening. The Greek government denied that it is happening, but the evidence is extremely compelling.
Talk more about this, Lucille, and this also shows the power of investigative journalism. While you say it's an open secret, it's astounding to hear this. You said he's former Greek Coast Guard saying, why did they do it in the middle of the day, as he's secretly saying this to someone?
Yes, that's right. I mean, this is just, I mean, you know, people don't want to, it's a very hostile environment, you know, speaking out and speaking the truth is a scary thing. And it's obviously much easier for me to do it here sitting in London than it is for someone who is in Greece. You know, it's perhaps a convenient truth for the rest of Europe and for many in Greece. I mean, they've been bearing the brunt of this for a very long time. So it's easier to kind of turn away. But it's very much, you know, when I first arrived on Samos to do some filming, I went to a restaurant. This is just anecdotal, but, you know, I went to a restaurant with the director and with one of our contributors. We sat there and someone came over to us and they were just chatting and, you know, they're like, oh, you're from Britain. Well, you know, talking to us, you know, I went on a Coast Guard vessel, and they sort of looked at us, and it was a kind of wink, wink, shove, shove. You know, maybe we do pushbacks. Pushbacks being the term that people use, which we don't use in the film because we think it sort of downplays the violent nature of these illegal expulsions. But this is the thing. Everybody knows about it, and maybe it's convenient, but no one dares speak out because it's a hostile environment, and it's scary to speak the truth.
So where is the accountability, for example, and we'll go into the hundreds of people who die in one incident, but of migrants being thrown overboard by the Greek Coast Guard? Has anyone been held accountable?
No one has been held accountable. That's the bottom line. You know, this is something that Frontex are aware of. It was very interesting in the week after the film came out, you know, the journalism continues, and then a news article came out in the EU Observer as well as El País, which demonstrated some serious incident reports that had been written by, I don't know if they were leaked or whether they got them through a Freedom of Information request, but they demonstrated that the Fundamental Rights Office at Frontex were aware that it was very likely that people had drowned, had been thrown into the water by the Greek Coast Guard. And yet nothing seems to happen, even though it says in Frontex's regulations that if there are human rights violations, that Frontex should withdraw, or at least temporarily withdraw for in the long term from that state where the human rights violations are occurring. But, you know, there's everyone knows about it. Who knows what's being said behind closed doors? We just don't know. There's a petition which is going around the EU that, you know, 30 MEPs or just more than 30 MEPs have signed asking for the EU to investigate what's happened. The opposition party, off the back of the BBC's investigation, spoke out against it, said that this needs to be investigated. So people are speaking out, but it's kind of, you know, it's business as usual. I mean, the week after the film came out, over 100 people were picked up by the Turkish Coast Guard in Greek assets. So, and including, I think, 14 children. So this seems to continue. And so far to date, no accountability.
I'm just looking at a piece in Al Jazeera that was dated June 17th. Last summer, a shocking video of asylum seekers cable tied and blindfolded in the back of a van on a Greek holiday island went viral online. At the time, the veracity of the video was questioned, and Theodosis Nikitaris, the mayor of Kos, filed a defamation case against the NGO that published it. Now, new documents obtained by the European Border and Coast Guard Agency Frontex confirmed the incident and pinned the responsibility on individuals it describes as likely working in concert with Greek authorities. This is what you were talking about.
Yes, I mean, I'm familiar with that video. It's it was posted on social media by Tommy Olsen of Aegean Boat Report, who has been screaming about this for years, and who was a consultant on the film. That video, we don't feature it in the film. BBC hasn't verified it, but as you say, Frontex have looked into it and have said that it is likely linked to the Greek Coast Guard. And what I would say, based on my experience of speaking with survivors as well as lawyers and humanitarian organizations working on the ground, which is that, you know, I've heard stories of this, of people having their eyes taped. I mean, I had one terrible story that I was told that you know, of people being captured, kidnapped, brought into a prison cell, kept overnight, and were stripped naked and had their eyes taped, and then overheard someone being beaten violently. They described also electrocutions. And the next day, they were all brought onto a Coast Guard vessel, including this man who was in, you know, barely alive and had been beaten all night. They had listened to the screams, and they put them on one of these motorless dinghies. And the man, they held the man in their arms, and he died in front of their eyes. I mean, it's entirely plausible that video is indeed an example of some of what's going on linked to the Greek Coast Guard. But, you know, as I say, the Greek authorities do deny it. And many of the the men in the balaclavas, maybe women as well, they often remove their insignia. So it's very difficult, really, to track down who is doing what. And it's very easy for the Greek authorities to keep denying it.
Lucille,
even though in so many cases you can see they're on a Greek Coast Guard vessel. But yeah.
Lucille Smith, talk about the criminalization of humanitarian workers.
Sure. I mean, unfortunately, this isn't something that we managed to include in the documentary. But yes, as you say, many humanitarian workers are criminalized now. So you would not be able to go to Greece and Italy as well, I would add. Although I'm not as familiar with Italy, but I understand that this is happening there as well. You would not be able to go out into the sea, and if somebody is drowning or needs help or is in distress, be able to rescue them. It is entirely now managed by the state. And, you know, it's difficult, you know, The cynic would say that what they have essentially done is removed the witnesses, so we can't really don't have proper eyes on what's going on. Others might say it shouldn't really be up to NGOs or humanitarian workers to be doing search and rescue. It should be run by the state. But either way, you know, we know that there are many individuals, Sarah Medini, Sean Binder. Sarah Medini is the subject of a Netflix drama, The Swimmers. She has been criminalized for doing search and rescue. This was all the way in 2019. And she wouldn't say, and Sean Binder, who we spoke to for this documentary, wouldn't say that, I don't want to speak for them, that they are smugglers. But those are the charges that they're facing. So it's really a way to take back control of search and rescue and perhaps also remove any witnesses. But obviously, since that has happened, it would seem that this forced expulsion has become really, really common, and looks, in, you know, very much like a policy. The repetitive nature of it looks like a policy, and there's a clear time, 2020, when this really begun, and the criminalization also of humanitarian workers also begun. And that's not to say that forced expulsions didn't happen before then, but the scale is really quite is dramatically bigger.
That was BBC producer Lucille Smith speaking about the 2024 documentary Dead Calm, Killing in the Med, which has led to Greek prosecutors opening a murder investigation of, quote, unknown perpetrators. We'll link to the film. That does it for our show. Happy News Year. I'm Amy Goodman.
You're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM.
When I say beat, you say banter. Beat. Banter. Beat.
Banter. When I say beat, you say banter. Beat.
Banter.
Beat. Banter.
Join us every Thursday at 1 on CFRC.